Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen. It's up, it's up. And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Hardwood Handicappers Podcast.
They're a bunch of guys who ain't never played the game, and they never got the girls in high school, and they just want to get in the game.
With your host, Jonathan Von Tobel.
See, the thing is, you guys look at me, you see the backwards hat, the gray socks, the funky outfit, and you say, now this guy's a chump, am I right?
No, f***ing geek. I'm a geek.
Only on the VSiN Podcast Network.
All right, let's start this episode of Hardwood Handicappers off the right way. Really excited for our first guest of the day. Simon Gersberg, CEO, ShotQuality.com. Is nice enough to give us some time in what has been a busy, I'm sure you're busy as a CEO, but also I'm not going to lie. So I was shocked. When I first stumbled onto Shot Quality and all of that stuff, I just assumed old dude running this thing. Not the case. You just graduate this weekend?
I did. Well, to be completely honest, I did not graduate. My friends graduated. I'm a little behind on credits because of Shot Quality.
Okay.
But attended graduation. I'm now technically a senior in college, but I'll be dropping out full-time to go full-time on Shot Quality.
Come on, let's go. You got to work a little bit harder then, huh? So, I mean, I wanted to start with some of like the more basic stuff before we get into actual, you know, the quality stuff and the numbers and whatnot. But, you know, I was reading a profile on you. Like, what's this journey been like for you? Because this is a pretty cool thing that you got going on. And I was reading a profile on you and how you got started with a roommate of yours in college and whatnot. Like, this seems to be a pretty cool and fun journey, especially for a young dude.
Yeah, it's definitely been fascinating and not where I expected to be probably 2 years ago when quarantine was happening. I didn't think I'd be here 2 years now to the day now. But I mean, how it all started was basically, a random roommate in college was one of the stars of the Colgate basketball team. He connected me to the Colgate men's basketball staff within my first week of college. I've always just been in love with analytics. I was writing baseball analytics articles throughout high school. Obsession of mine, just trying to find competitive advantages and edges for coaches. And then was doing basically this entire process by hand. So charting the quality of shot, what percentage each shot probability has of going in. So when, for example, Tucker Richardson, just guy on Colgate, great off the dribble, 3-point shooter takes a three. That's going to be better than when I take an off the dribble three. Everything's always individualized. Then eventually down the road, found a way to automate everything using the same process I used for Colgate's team. And then, I mean, obviously a lot happened between then and now, but obviously the data is very strong and it fuels the coaching customer base and the betting customer base as well.
Yes. And that's kind of what I want to get into too, because as you kind of stated there, originally it seems to start as a tool for college basketball coaches. Now it's really catching on in terms of public consumption. And now, you know, the 4A, what was it? This is your third season in terms of tracking NBA shot quality, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you 4A into the NBA numbers. So like when you look at like the, now it's being used for public consumption, I'm really curious, like when sports gamblers want to start use this in terms of using this as a handicapping tool, is there any resistance for you on that part? Did you originally want this just to be for coaching? There are some out there who still have a resistance to sports gambling becoming more widespread. It seems that you're more into it being used as a tool for handicappers though.
Yes. No, I think it could. It's definitely going to have to be both. It just has to be separated. So like we'll have two different sites for shotqualitybets.com and shotquality for the coaching side. But the truth is like the data fuels both sides. It's the same data, but obviously it's just doing two different things for those two customers. So no, we'll definitely start ramping up a service, I think, by October for the college men's season coming up, and then obviously the next NBA season as well.
So explain if you can, you dived into it a little bit there when you were talking about, you know, the spot of dribble and everything, but you see some people that are still resistant to something like shot quality, right? Like there's a lot of people who look at it and go, oh, okay. Yeah. They're up 3-0 in the series, whatever. but it's all part of this, I think, bigger picture, like conversation where all of a sudden like analytics and data have like become these pejorative terms where people view them negatively. But for people who are listening to this, who might have a more open mind, sum it up, if you could, like more of like, this is why this would be useful to you when it comes to handicapping, not only just NBA, but college basketball.
Really funny. This is my favorite example that somebody's talked about it with. Eli Hershkovich. He works for the Lions. He basically told me it's just a quantified eye test. Like that's the way it should always be. It's like you watch a game and you see a lot of teams missing good looks, or you see a lot of bad looks being taken, it's what you would expect to happen. It's so important that it lines up with the eye test. People are always going to be trolls and doubt analytics, like you're saying, and think of it as a derogatory way. But the most important thing is that it lines up with what your eyes are seeing. So that's always what matters to me. The way it's calculated, it's sound. It basically just utilizes the player's historic data and valuing more of the current season for each individualized player in each spot. So when, for example, Chris Paul takes an off the dribble mid-range, that's going to be a better shot than when I take an off the dribble mid-range or Alfred Payton takes an off the dribble mid-range. So everything is individualized for each guy and then summed up throughout the total of the game, coming up with the overall shot quality score.
Yeah, and one of the examples that I used in this is the first season and really the postseason that I started using your site and your numbers. I thought Phoenix Dallas, like that series, was a really good example of how your numbers and your data could really work. Because if you looked at it from game one, Mavericks lose, win the shot quality score. Game two, get blown out, but cover. If you look at the shot quality score, Phoenix's numbers were right in line with their shot quality stuff on the road in Dallas. And you mix that in with everything else. When you talk about Dallas, better offensive efficiency on the road, wide open shots, if you tracked it by NBA tracking data, were still there for them. Catch and shoot was there. So you put it all together and you get to game seven and the market's like, yeah, 7-point favorite in favor of the Phoenix Suns. And using your data along with everything else, you're like, well, the Suns actually haven't really been playing as well as the market would indicate here. And then we saw what happened in game seven. Like, I think that's one of the really good examples of how your data really can help a handicapper in projecting forward or looking at some of these games where the market might be seeing something else, but the data tells you another story.
Exactly. It's always got to be process over result for everything. The market's going to move based off the result, but everyone else should move based off the process.
Yep. So speaking of Dallas, so they were up, what I think, are they up 4-0 in the series by shot quality score standpoint?
It's interesting. So technically they've won every single shot quality score. But if you actually sum up, so like that's not the best way to actually show what the score of the series should be. We basically do it based off the win percent. Mm-hmm. So two of those games that Dallas won the shot quality, they were 50-50 games. So that basically counts as half of a win, half of a win. If you add it up and sum it up, they're basically up in the series like 2.2 to 1.8. So they definitely have a lead in the series and they've won every shot quality score technically. But it's definitely a tight series. And obviously based on the score, it's not. So it's interesting in that 4-game sample.
Yeah, it is. Well, and I also like, I feel like somewhat vindicated, and this goes kind of back to what we're talking about here, where, so after the first 3 games and you see the shot quality numbers and how Dallas has been performing, and then you realize that in games 1 and 2, right, Golden State closes 5.5 and then 6. And, you know, they cover the numbers, all of that stuff. But we're coming back here for a closeout game potentially, and the market's really adjusted. They're up to a 7.5-point favorite. So the market's increased the power rating here in Golden State because of the way that they've been performing. But again, going back to some of these shot quality metrics, this has been a much closer series than would the surface look would give you. So thus, for me and for some handicappers, it should be, it'll look immediately at a Dallas Mavericks team who has been underperforming some of their shot quality metrics, no?
Yes, no, that's the exact process that I think would be smart. I'm not going to advise it because I'm terrified too.
Yep.
I don't want the Twitter trolls coming for me.
No, of course. Well, and also like, look, I like data and numbers and analytics much as the next guy. There's something to be said of like really good teams and guys who've just done it before. Like at some point there's like totally a human element of it.
Experience. Yeah, totally.
Yep. Absolutely. And if one team's going to overperform their shot quality metric, I would think it'd be a team with Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson and coached by Steve Kerr. Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
So like when you're talking about like one of the things that I was talking to my co-host Matt Humans about, I want to get your thoughts on this, is I really thought that using your data, the value was really maximized in these playoff series because you're facing the same opponent over the course of a best of seven. I felt like it was like there's data there and there's quality there to use it, obviously, when it comes to like a regular season. But there's so many different outliers when it comes to that, right? Is it a Wednesday, second leg of a back-to-back after you just played in Dallas? Like all of those sort of things. When in a series, you're facing the same opponents with the same tendencies, game plans might adjust. But I thought like when you really looked at it from an NBA standpoint, I think these data is really maximized in terms of playoff series settings. Would you agree with that or no?
Absolutely. No, that's exactly how I feel about it too, because you're getting the same exact context variables that are hard to predict out. Like for example, Bam Adebayo guarding Joel Embiid, or for example, player X is out. And now that the next night they're playing the Orlando Magic instead of the Phoenix Suns. Like there's just like stuff when you play a different team, there's going to be different contextual factors that are going to be hard to predict out. But when you're playing the same team multiple nights, there's less contextual factors. I think there's actually different contextual factors in the playoffs, just stuff like role players underperforming, home away splits, stuff like that. But it's different and it's definitely more predictive because you're playing the same team like almost every other night.
Yep. So I'm curious, like what would you say that if you're looking at some of your data when it comes to the NBA, are there any big differences when it comes to shot quality data and calculating it when it comes to NBA and college? The games are played a little bit differently, more low post oriented in college hoops as opposed to the NBA, which is a little bit more spread out, 3-point shooting. Are there any real big differences in terms of that?
The biggest difference is more variability in the NBA because there's more minutes, so more threes and more shots. So it's basically over the course of the season, the shot quality scores, like if you were to sum up and see like how predictive shot quality scores are to actual results, they're more predictive in college just because there's less minutes in the game. So they line up more frequently because there's less variability than the NBA game. But it's not even that the data is worse. It's the same data. Mm-hmm. It's just because there's less variability. So that's just one example of how they're different. And obviously the play styles too, like obviously playing a little more low post in college. I mean, I think a lot of college is moving more towards a little more rim and three stuff. But NBA is obviously way, way 5 years ahead of college in that way.
Yeah. So, and what I really like too is, you know, the conversation around basketball, which is like the death of the mid-range shot and whatnot. But the cool thing about shot quality, because you've brought up Chris Paul, you know, a couple of times, is, you know, a team like Phoenix, who's really mid-range oriented, when I was going through some of your numbers, I expected like, oh, well, like their shot quality luck, because you have that metric right on the right side, they'd probably be a little lucky just because they're a mid-range oriented team. But that's not the case, because you have two elite mid-range scorers in Devin Booker and Chris Paul. So those mid-range shots are more valuable for a team like that, as opposed to like, I don't know, like an Orlando Magic type team.
Exactly. No, that's the biggest thing about the site, and what honestly like makes me the most happy when I talk about it with the coach, because I'm not against the mid-range shot. Like it actually like bothers me when people say like, oh, like only rim and three. It's about getting the right shot for the right guy. Yep. Like when Kevin Durant takes a mid-range, like you're not going to get mad at Kevin Durant for taking a pull-up mid-range that he's going to shoot like 55% on. So yeah, that always bothers me, and I'm happy you said that as well.
I've had that conversation a lot too, because for some reason, when I started covering the NBA, I've become some weird defender of the league. Like people always come at me with stuff like that. And it's like, and it to your point, like, yeah, it's not about getting rid of the mid-range shot. It's about getting rid of the mid-range shot for guys who shouldn't be shooting it. Like Kawhi Leonard from mid-range is freaking awesome. Like, of course you want him taking a mid-range shot, but I don't want, you know, player X to start coming up and stepping into mid-range jumpers. Like, no, of course not.
Exactly. Yep.
So one of the things too is I'm really curious as I kind of look forward, and I was looking at a couple of examples, just I really wanted to dive into it, was using what we're talking about when it comes to like record luck, that you have that in terms of your team standings, to project forward for teams with win totals, and specifically teams who are kind of rolling it back here a little bit. One of the best examples was, so last season, One of the teams that I had circled to play this year under their win total was New York, the Knicks. I thought they were a team that got very lucky in terms of the way they played defense, the way they played offense.
Yep.
Didn't really get to quantify that. Then I look at your numbers today and I'm searching through the site. And I'm like, oh, wow. Like, look at that. Last year, I think they were last in terms of record luck. And there was some negative regression coming for them. So if you're talking about, I don't think it, and you can correct me on this maybe, because I don't think it necessarily translates for each team because roster change, coaching changes, things like that. But if it's a team that largely brings back their core, I think there's a real value in looking at that record luck and projecting for win totals and maybe seeing teams that are going to go over or under their win total.
I think that is really, really interesting point you brought up. The only thing that pisses me off is I'm actually a Knicks fan. So when I saw it on the site last year that they would keep winning games and keep losing the shot quality, the main reason was, so the numbers at the beginning of the season, it actually updates retroactively. So let's just say, for example, Julius Randle last year ended the season shooting 41% from three. His career number is 33. Mm-hmm. So through the first 30 games of the season, until the sample gets big enough, he's going to stay like closer to his career than the individual last season. So he probably ended last season in terms of like the expected 3-point percentage number around like 36 or 37, because he's not a 41% 3-point shooter, but that's what he's shooting throughout this point in the season. So it'll recorrect those games. So even at the beginning of the season, the Knicks were probably even way worse than they ended up until that got corrected. But yeah, that's like one of the best examples of a team just like, I don't want to say getting lucky, but just like the way they were playing wasn't sustainable. They actually upgraded their roster, got better players for the next season, and they actually played like significantly worse as a team as well. So yeah, that is one of the best examples for sure. And so, the Bucks too, actually, sorry to interrupt,
no,
but they were also, they were like the number one team in positive record luck the entire regular season. It's not separated playoffs or regular season on the site, actually. I should probably add that. But for the Bucks in the regular season, were the number one positive regression team going into the playoffs, and then obviously won it all and we're cooking.
So I think really, like, and like, I like this kind of stuff, man. Like, this is so much fun to dive into, click around. Do the box scores on your site, are they live during games? Like, can you track in-game shot quality?
Not yet, but that is something hopefully moving forward we might look forward to. It's like usually like 2 to 4 hours after the game around.
Okay. But well, because the reason I asked, you know, I was reading a couple of your blog posts, you know, in the Grizzlies game against the Timberwolves. Like, it's a really good example of like shot quality and how that could play out, not only over the course of, you know, a larger sample size in terms of series, but in a game, right? In terms of dominating shot quality, but being down. And then all of a sudden in a fourth quarter, just like that, the shot quality starts to correct itself and the Memphis Grizzlies come back and they end up winning that game. And, you know, just thinking again, covering this from a gambling standpoint, I mean, the value of something like that from an in-game wagering standpoint, it's interesting because it's a smaller sample size. So it's not necessarily going to correct itself in a game, but the value in that in terms of in-game line versus shot quality, where it's at and trying to find some edges there would be very advantageous, I think, for a lot of bettors.
Definitely. Yeah, it is very, very interesting for sure.
Yeah, man. Hey, I think this is really cool, man. Like, I got to tell you, like, I'm clicking through this and doing all this sort of stuff. And I know too, like, I've seen you retweeting everything. It is catching on. Nick Wright, who very much does not like advanced analytics, using yours and invoking shot quality data to prove his point on some of these sites. And now, it is pretty interesting when guys like that start to use this. And like, this is starting from an NBA standpoint to really catch on in the masses, I think. I've seen your brand can like with NBA stuff more and more over the last few weeks than I personally have ever seen.
Yeah, no, I didn't really see this coming as well. I think the main reason for it is exactly what you were saying, though, is like the fact that this data is so relevant in the playoffs. In the regular season, it definitely has relevancy, and it's will be interesting, like the first 20 games in terms of like regression candidates for teams and players. But for the playoffs, it's just like the best contextual factors. So that's probably why it's getting, I guess, a little more popular now, obviously.
Yeah. Well, Simon, again, Simon Gersberg, CEO, shotquality.com. I don't want to take a lot of your time, but I just wanted to, you know, talk to you for a couple minutes, get some insight on everything. It's been absolutely fantastic in terms of tracking this work. And you got a subscriber in me, and I have been telling people as much as possible to try it out, because it's been, and like, to be honest, it's been a really good tool for me, and using it with a lot of other stuff as well, you know, like this compared with, like, I'm a big fan of cleaning the glass. So like their non-garbage time minutes, things like that, you know, like this Celtics Heat series we're going to see resume later today. By the shot quality standards, I think they've won the shot quality score 3 out of the 4 games that they've played. They got a positive 13.4 net rating in non-garbage time minutes. Like all of these things put together, it tells you that the Celtics team is performing much better than they probably should be against Miami. And those things are obviously really valuable, man.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate it, dude. I know you're busy. I won't, again, take a lot of your time, but thanks a lot for hopping on, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You got it, man. All right, dude. I'll tweet it out, link you in it, but thanks again.
This is the Hardwood Handicappers podcast.
All right, loaded episode of Hardwood Handicappers on this Wednesday. We just got done talking with Simon Gersberg, CEO of ShotQuality.com. And now, a man of very equal importance, because we got a lot to get to in the next month. Jim Root, three-man weave, field of 68 as well. What's up, dude?
Oh, not too much. I mean, what an underwhelming follow-up to Shot Quality. You get me? I feel bad for the listeners. If they're sticking around, they're the true Hardwood Handicapper fans.
Nah, no way. Well, I don't know if there's Hardwood Handicapper fans per se. I think my mom makes up most of the downloads, so we'll see. but this is a cool time of year because they have postseason slowing down. Obviously we're down to, you know, every other day in terms of being played, but we're a month away from the NBA draft. And I know you like to follow the NBA draft as well. So what better way to start this conversation than talk about some of the lottery prospects and some high risers after the NBA combine. And I know you watch these guys a lot closer than I do, so I want to get your thoughts on a couple of them. But where I wanted to start was the obvious place, which is the big three, as we are going to call them, because it does seem that we only have three guys in play for the top overall pick. And at least by one odds maker, that is the case. Jabari Smith Jr. out of Auburn, Chet Holmgren out of Gonzaga, and Paolo Banchero out of Duke. Now, I was surprised about this, Jim, and I get your initial thoughts on it. So most spots have Jabari Smith Jr. is about like $1.60-ish favorite to go with the first overall pick. It's kind of surprised about the move after the Orlando Magic got the first selection. Bet Online has Jabari Smith Jr. as a -225 favorite to go first overall. That's wild, isn't it?
It's crazy. I'm guessing it has to do with there's a report, I think it was yesterday, that Jonathan Givony from ESPN basically said Orlando seems settled on Smith. Oklahoma City seems settled on Holmgren. The players have talked about it. They're excited. It's not obviously like public, but he's saying he's hearing this and he's heard that those guys are fairly clued into their destinations, which a month out from the draft, I'm pretty surprised that there's something that locked in. There's a lot of workouts to go through. If I'm Orlando, I want to get Paolo Banchero and Jabari Smith in the same gym and throw them at each other. I'm sure their agents will not allow that, but right. That's a lot of certainty for this point in the process. I think I saw DraftKings and FanDuel had Banchero something like 10-1 to go to that top spot, which I guess since it's an information-based event, then you really can know, and there's not a lot of uncertainty there, but that just seems like pushing him out of this top three a little bit more than he needs to be.
Yeah, and we're going to get to him as like a player, but like I put in my notes for Banchero, would you agree with the assessment that he seems the most NBA ready, like to get off the floor running? I think it would be Banchero out of those three that would initially be the one that I think, like in terms of catching up with his body, his game, he would be most ready from day one.
Yeah, he looks very comfortable in his body. Like the size, he's filled out. Smith has the length and some of the attributes too, but Banchero like is an NBA ready 6'10", 250, skilled with the ball in his hands. So you throw that in with the fact that he also has plenty of upside. I mean, he as an initiator, I am surprised that he's already getting a little bit wedged out of that conversation.
Yep. And like personally, I like all these players, especially the last couple of days watching more and more of them. Like Jabari Smith Jr. is not a guy that I watched a ton of during the regular season, but watching more, it is hard not to be impressed with his skill set. But man, you watch Banchero, when you got 6'9", 250, and like you said, it's a great way to put it, comfortable in his body and the ability to work from all areas of the floor. He's really exciting player. So let's start here because I want to kind of go through these prospects, tie them to teams and see your thoughts on each one of these and see if we can see where they might fit as well. But when I watched Jabari Smith Jr., and this is kind of where I wanted to begin, is it wrong of me, like when we're talking about like why you would take it? Because again, like with the first overall pick, you want a game changer. You want a franchise guy. You want a dude who is going to transcend, essentially be your block to build on. This is a very simplistic way to put it, so I understand this, so don't kill me for it. But what is Smith besides a really, really good 3-and-D player in the NBA?
I'm not going to kill you for it. That's kind of the question where it's like, in this era, if your top three franchise changer isn't a guy you truly throw the ball to, he's more of a play finisher than he is a play creator. And maybe that's at this point in his development. He's got the beautiful jumper with the high release. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff where when Auburn needed a basket and threw it to him, it was just like, all right, I can get you a tough jumper. He did a lot of isolation against switches where he get a smaller defender on him and he would just get a fadeaway jumper over the top. And look, he made a ton of them, but I don't know that he's going to be able to attack in the same way in the NBA. There's a lot more versatility in the way people guard. There's not as many small guards you can pick on like there are in the SEC. So yeah, I mean, the fact that he doesn't really do things with the ball in his hands, he doesn't create for others. I love the skill set, but there's a reason. I think there's some people in the draft Twitter sphere, which is a deep, dark place that I don't encourage people to dive too far into, but there's some people that have him fourth behind Jaden Ivey. Just, I think because of exactly what you're mentioning, where he's not really a give the ball to him guy and let him initiate. So can he be the best player on a title team or a deep run in the playoffs? I don't know.
Yeah. And that's like, you don't want to undersell it. And 3-and-D guys are really important. But again, the value of the first overall pick, you want a dude who's going to change things. You want a guy who is going to be multifaceted with his game. And while I think Jabari Smith could be pretty good, I just don't really see it in terms of the first overall selection. But here's another thing too, which is, this is the interesting about the NBA draft, right? In the NFL draft, you will see teams focus on need. Like generally it is a need filled kind of draft. So if I need an outside linebacker and I'm in a spot where a good outside linebacker is there, I'm going to take an outside linebacker. In the NBA, wherever you're picking, especially at the top of the draft, generally it's just projection and talent. And like, you want the most talented guy. But I bring that up because like, I feel like Chet Holmgren is still the most talented guy in this draft. But then when you look at the Orlando Magic signing Wendell Carter Jr. to an extension in this right at the beginning of this season, right? They really like Wendell Carter Jr. as a center. He had a really good year. It does make a little bit more positional sense to go outside of Chet Holmgren and center because you feel like you have your guy in Wendell Carter Jr. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then they've, you know, the report came out that they're kind of okay with Mo Bamba probably not being on the Magic next year, and those rumors are flying around. But yeah, it's in the NBA with the way it's as positionless or close to, it's evolving that way. I don't think they should be drafting by need. And I know Carter played alongside Bamba sometimes this year. He played in a couple two big lineups. Holmgren has the ability to do that too. He played alongside Drew Timmy. It really, his appeal is that he can be the floor stretcher around that. He can pass a little bit. He can dribble the ball. He and Carter could both protect the rim. So maybe there'd be some hiccups with their perimeter defense, but I think that's something you figure out as you go along rather than forcing yourself to take Smith because you think he fits better. I like you said, fit should not be a concern at the top of the draft.
Yeah. And that kind of gets me back to like, so that was going to be my question about Holmgren. So you think he could play like a 4 or 5 with a Carter type? Cause here's the thing. Like we think about like the Boston Celtics, for example, right? Robert Williams is their center, but one of the big changes with what they did was defensively, he's actually their power forward. Because that was the big thing. Now he's off ball. He crashes into help, makes the biggest difference in the world with the way they play, and more traditional like drop and pick and roll coverage. Al Horford's the guy defensively. And then you flip that role offensively. I think you could kind of see that with a Wendell Carter Jr., Chet Holmgren front court if you're with Orlando. And I also just think like, again, like the more I watch Chet Holmgren, because it's not like I was on the fence of like whether or not he was going to be good. I think he's going to be good. But watching him more the last couple of days, I don't know how you pass up on a guy like that. Like the potential is really high, I think, for a guy like Holmgren.
Yeah, the Bucks are the same way with they use Giannis and Brooke Lopez. Like put your best defender as the off-ball destroyer, put him on a bad defender so that he can just help like crazy. And that's, like you said, that's how the Celtics optimize Robert Williams. I think Holmgren can do that. The easy knock on him is the frame, but like he's 19. You can put him in an NBA weight program. I think he's going to be able to put on some strength. The weird hesitance I have with him when I watch him both on TV and in person, he just moves a little slowly. I compare it to Ant-Man when he gets really big in the Marvel movies and suddenly his reflexes are slow and it's kind of elongated. But that's also probably something he can grow into. He sprouted and became real tall and long at the same time. So he's still uncomfortable in his body, kind of the opposite of what we said about Banchero. I think he can definitely get there, but there is something kind of like loping about his movements that is a little bit concerning, but everything else, the skill set, the intelligence, the IQ, the shot blocking, like he's going to be really, really good. I'm less concerned about the strength. So it's really just the movement thing for me.
Well, and I think like I'm not a scientist. He does genetically look like a guy who's going to be tough to put weight on. Right.
Yes, true. The shoulders aren't very wide.
Right? Yeah. Like, I don't think you're getting really that far with that. And some guys it works for, but you know, it works for a Kevin Durant when you're as skilled and as quick as he is. And like, when it comes to Holmgren, he does seem to have like that in his bag. Like I was watching a couple of the things where he can create pretty well and he can hit mid-range shots. There are a couple of possessions where, you know, he like dribbles into an elbow jumper and he hits it pretty smoothly. And you kind of like stuff like that. What do you think his ceiling is offensively? Because defensively, it's easy to watch those highlights and he's coming behind little guys and he's swatting shots out of the air. I think, did he average like 3 blocks a game or something like that for Gonzaga? But what do you make of him in terms of his offensive skill set outside of like trailer and transition, hitting threes, more half court oriented? What is Chet Holmgren?
Yeah, I think he can be kind of the off the bounce. He can give you a little bit more of that. Like, he's not Jabari Smith level with that ability, but I think he can get there. I mean, he was so non-central to their offensive attack this year. I think he only took 10 shots in like, you know, less than half of their games. They were focused on playing through Drew Timmy in the post, and Andrew Nembhard, a name we'll bring up later, was running everything from the backcourt. So we haven't seen his full potential offensively. He kind of got to be a complimentary guy, which almost was really ideal for the way he fit at this stage in his career. But because of how smooth the stroke is and the fact that he can put the ball on the ground and he's not, you know, he doesn't have a shaky handle really. I think there is a high ceiling there. You just kind of have to figure out what it's going to be and how he fits alongside the guys that he's going to play with.
So for you, he's the best player in this draft?
I think he's the highest ceiling, and that's probably why I would take him first, because I think there's just a chance that he's completely ludicrous and a guy we haven't really seen before. The unicorn word gets thrown around probably a little too frequently, right, but he has the potential to be all of that. I mean, Anthony Davis didn't really look like a guy we'd put a ton of weight on either, but he had the shot blocking and he added the shooting. And Holmgren, maybe he'll, you know, he's probably not going to be Anthony Davis. That's a really high expectation to put on him, but he can be something similar, I think, in the way he impacts both ends and gives you a lot as a shot blocker and as a creator.
Like 20 pounds heavier with muscle. That's a good visual for Chet Holmgren. I would love to see it. Like in 5 years, just like jacked Chet Holmgren, who's still as massive as he is. So let me ask you this. When you're looking at this overall from the standpoint of like, because this is what I always think when it comes to drafts, and this is what always makes me laugh. Because sometimes it's, I don't know, I think I'm using this term right, like Occam's razor, like sometimes it, like the solution is like the most obvious choice. Is that what it is? So like, for example, it's always weird to me in draft stuff and with all this knowledge out there, everything you read about these top guys, almost every paragraph you will see in some form or fashion, Chet Holmgren is the most talented player in this draft or has a highest ceiling in this draft. And yet we see the odds and he's not projected to be the first overall selection. And we see people doing everything and saying, hey, what about Shaedon Sharpe as a first overall selection or Javen Ivey? Sometimes it's just that simple. Right. And when you look at like, and I use the example of this past NFL draft, you know, people are talking about 4 quarterbacks, 5 quarterbacks, you know, fifth year control, all this stuff. But then every report you read is this quarterback class sucks. It's not really that good. Probably not going to get that many guys going. And that's the most obvious thing that happens, right? Only one guy goes in the first round. And that's what kind of keeps bringing me back to Chet Holmgren, which is, I think there's some really good value in taking him, despite that information, Gavoni's report that says that it does look like the league is assuming that Smith is going to be the guy first overall. I just feel like if you're Orlando and you're sitting there looking at this, like screw fit, you can make it fit if you got enough good enough coaching staff. Why would you pass up on this for what could be, like we talked about, a good 3-and-D player? It just, to me, it makes more sense it would be Holmgren, thus playing him to go first overall.
Yeah, and it's a little surprising too, because John Hammond, the GM there, I mean, that's the guy that took the big swing on Giannis and has kind of been known for, give me a ton of length and even some skill and we'll figure out the rest, we'll develop. So maybe he sees a little more in what Smith can do on the ball. But I think another fun way to put it is Holmgren is the process guy. Like if you are trying to run the process of Philly or what Oklahoma City is basically doing right now, just taking the biggest swings, I think he's the guy you look at. And that's why he's getting mocked to number 2 to Oklahoma City fairly consistently across the board.
But having said that, because I love what Oklahoma City is doing, he'd be freaking awesome in Oklahoma City. Like I think he would fit so well with what they do.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, you put him with Gilgeous Alexander and Pokuševski is kind of in that same developmental vein. They're trying to figure out what he's going to be. I think they could recreate the famous Bucks picture with Giannis, Larry Sanders, and John Henson stretching their arms from 3 points to 3 point line. You could do that with Holmgren and Pokuševski and insert player
Giddy.
Yep. There. Yeah, Giddy. That
yep.
works.
Yep. Be ridiculous. All right. So that leads us to the third guy of the big three, Paolo Banchero. We kind of alluded to, you know, how both of our thoughts here. I'm a really big fan of Banchero. And as I mentioned, seems like he's going to be very NBA ready. He seems like he's got a lot of growth there too. I would ask this because you mentioned his passing ability. Does he have the ability, you think, to become one of these like point forward type of players? Because he looks like a pretty good passer in transition. There's multiple times. I don't know about strictly running an offense, but he does look like a guy that could initiate your offense pretty frequently in the NBA.
Yeah, I think he's way more capable of running a pick and roll. I think Jabari Smith ran like 12 pick and rolls the entire season. Banchero ran something like 70. Like they were comfortable putting the ball in his hands, having Mark Williams or whoever screen for him and let him operate. I also thought their offense was often best when they played through him in like mid post, because he's huge and he can attack one-on-one. But if you send help, he is a good enough passer to see where it's coming from, process that and hit the right pass. And that's, I mean, the processing speed, that's kind of huge for your primary creator or even secondary in the NBA. I was pretty impressed with him all season and his ability to spray the ball around and make the right read. So I think he's fully capable of that. I go back to it. I like you said, he's the most NBA ready guy. I think he's probably going to average the most points as a rookie. Just looking at the class and is assuming he gets in a place where he gets a ton of shots up. But the playmaking is there too. So I'm a big fan of Banchero as well. I would have him too behind Holmgren and feel pretty decent about it.
One of the things that sticks out about his numbers, 33.8% from three, but he shot like 73% from the free throw line. That should project to a little bit of a better 3-point shot. Any concerns there, or should you think that, you know, 1 year, kind of maybe an off year, he should be a better 3-point shooter?
Yeah, he took him fairly confidently. Like he took more than Holmgren did, higher volume, and against their best competition, he shot 35%. You know, it's a little smaller sample, only 16 games, but I think the stroke is there. When I look at it mechanically, it looks pretty smooth to me. I don't think there's any broken hitchiness to it. So I would estimate that he becomes a pretty solid 3-point shooter in the league.
So the commonality between Holmgren and Jabari Smith is, I think they translate to be like above average defenders. What about Banchero? Because there are some pretty odd defensive low lights for him when you watch him at times.
Yeah, there's he creates some of the events a little bit, but he's not as fleet of foot. He is not the shot blocker that either of those guys is, despite also being, you know, that's 6'10", you know, big, has the size. So if you're not getting that kind of impact, I could see maybe being a little lower on it. But I don't, because of the size, and he at least has, you know, knowledge of the game and instincts, I think he should be able to get there. Like, I don't think he'll be Jabari Parker defensively, where he's lost and says, I don't get paid to play defense, that kind of thing. So I think he should be acceptable. But yeah, he's not going to be a stopper. He's not going to be like a all defense candidate ever in his career.
Is he good as a screener? Because like Houston's got the third overall pick. And I just keep going back to like a Jalen Green, Paolo Banchero pick and roll, which could be probably, I would think, pretty devastating.
Yeah, I think he's solid. And he did screen a lot this year. I'm looking at like 30 possessions as a roll man this year, not a ton.
But they
did a lot of just kind of spread and attack for Duke. They want to get you on your heels and kind of beat you one-on-one. So I don't know how much he was really used as like, let's create the mismatch by having him screen. I know that's such a huge thing in the playoffs right now, but I'm sure he can get there. He's got the size, he's got the bulk. I would think he could become a problem in that regard.
So when you're looking at this overall, some spots, did you say he was as high as 10-1 right now, Paolo Banchero, to be the first overall pick?
I think I looked yesterday, and that's where I saw him at like DraftKings or FanDuel.
Yeah, personally, if I'm getting double digits on that, that might be worth the like Holmgren and Banchero would be the way that I would play this. Like, I'm not comfortable laying a price with Jabari Smith, given everything that we've talked about here. And if you're telling me that Banchero is 10-1, a guy that I think is most NBA ready and looks like he would be pretty damn good for a lot of these teams. And looking at this right now in front of me, DraftKings, 9-1 right now over at DraftKings, still in that range. Personally, that sounds like something that's worth grabbing for the first overall pick.
Yeah. I mean, if this was 3 days before the draft and we're pretty certain all these reports are concrete and a lot closer to coming to fruition, maybe I'd feel less certain, but it's a whole month. I really feel like a lot can change. And I do think it's all coming from that one report from Givony. And if he's wrong or got fed some bad information, or even if something changes in the next couple of weeks, suddenly you're sitting there with one of the best three players at 9 or 10 to 1. It seems worthwhile.
Well, and I always like the wording of the report, so I pulled it up while you were talking. So he says, this is from the report, quote, while Magic executives made it clear they will conduct a thorough process, even extending beyond the widely believed top three prospects, most NBA teams firmly believe that it's a formality and that Smith is all but assured to become the top pick. So it sounds like his sources aren't even coming from the Magic. It just sounds like it's coming from every other team but the Magic.
Right, and maybe that's what the teams other than the Magic want. Like, right. Go ahead, take Jabari Smith. We want the other two guys to fall.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a really good point. So, all right, we'll see. So now, as we're kind of waiting, NBA draft props have yet to come up. So what I wanted this conversation to be more like was talking about some of these prospects, how they project, and guesstimating where, like, a draft position could be and where you'd be willing to play them over, under, something like that. So let's go to, you know, I mentioned one guy that has been bantied about potentially as, you know, a top pick in the NBA draft. I don't see it personally. I see the explosiveness and the talent, but I don't see first overall selection. That would be Jaden Ivey out of Purdue. Is it prisoner of the moment because he's just become a superstar at this point? I get a ton of Ja Morant vibes watching him play offensively.
Yeah, he has the same kind of burst. Like, yeah. They are both like holy crap level athletes where I said everything Holmgren looks like he's kind of loping and a little slow. Everything Jaden Ivey does is sudden. It's like, oh, okay, he's got burst to his first step. When he gets a defensive rebound and he pushes in transition, he can glide and cover the entire court in 3 or 4 dribbles, get straight to the rim. So, yeah, I like very impressed by him, but I don't think he has the same kind of playmaking, decision-making as the instincts that Morant does. So the physical traits, I think, match, but maybe he's more likely to become Russell Westbrook in that sometimes he's frustrating in his inability to fully impact winning at that level. I mean, he kind of vanished from their loss to St. Peter's in the NCAA tournament. It was like, where's Jaden Ivey? Wasn't even shooting for most of the game, and then he kind of did late. But I think the Morant stuff is more physical attributes, and there's more to it that I don't think he brings.
Yeah, and like, because when you watch him, he really thrives. Like, if he's not winning on the first step and just blowing by guys, or coming screaming off of a screen like on a pin down or something like that, and either getting ahead of steam to the basket or, you know, pulling up and hitting a three, because he seems to be ahead of where Morant is as a shooter. But if that's not going really well, like, I have questions about him running a pick and roll. He doesn't really seem to have like a mid-range, like jumper or floater type of thing. So like, if he's playing against drop coverage, can he take advantage of that like Morant can? Doesn't really seem like that's the case. And then the other part of it, I put this down in my notes, risk taker on defense, shitty Marcus Smart on that end of the floor. Would that be like, you know, just like a risk taker who's like going for steals and is trying to get pretty aggressive, and Marcus Smart, to give him credit, he knows more often than not the right time to do that. There's a lot of different possessions where you're watching Jaden Ivey and he's jumping for a steal or something that he's completely caught out of position, and his guy's like cutting to the basket or catching the wide open for a three, and he's scrambling back to contest. Like I think like a very bad version of Marcus Smart was what I was watching on defense.
Yeah. The knock on Purdue all season was that they were not good enough defensively. And he was the reason for that. They were huge. Like, they were one of the biggest teams in the entire country. He always had, most of the time he had a 7'4" shot blocker behind him, and Trevion Williams is a decent rim protector, not great. But so he always had cover behind him, which maybe infused some of the confidence to take those gambles. But yeah, he wasn't a guy that you could throw at the other team's best player and say, hey, like, kind of take the head off the snake, defend him, get in his grill, which is disappointing for someone of his athletic caliber. That was always kind of a knock. It's like, why isn't Jaden Ivey getting after it more defensively? Whether it's causing more havoc or just, like you said, or staying in somebody's pocket, hip pocket, and bothering them. He was not a great defender this year, and I think that's going to probably carry over into the pros.
So right now, the draft order, barring any trades, of course, we have the Sacramento Kings at number 4. I've seen a couple of mock drafts putting him at number 4, but the Kings have a litany of guards. I don't think it really makes a ton of sense, although it's the Kings. So we saw them go with Mitchell last year. That really screwed me on a ticket by like one, I think it was like a half position or something in the draft. But I'd be really curious, like, I feel like he'd get a draft position of like 4.5, thinking that like the Kings are going to be the spot. And I would look to play that over. The, you know, Pistons might go for him. The Pacers might go for him, but I don't know if he's going to land in the top 4, especially with, we're going to get to like Keegan Murray. Keegan Murray seems like a guy who's going to be a perfect fit for Sacramento, what they need. But if it's like 4.5, I'd look to play him over. No.
Yeah, I would too. Cause you're basically saying, is he Sacramento's pick or not? Yeah. And I would say, because I think we're pretty established on the top 3. I don't think there any of them are going to gamble for Ivy. So yeah, I would lean towards over. I think there's a chance even the mystery box that is Shaedon Sharpe gets some love from the Kings there. So yeah, I would go over that. And I agree. I think that's what his draft position will be.
Yeah. All right. So you know what? Let's go there then. Because Shaedon Sharpe, I was going through some of the stuff and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's right. I'm like, he was at Kentucky, but he didn't play. This is from Raphael Barlow's director of scouting at NBA Big Board. He talked to an anonymous scout, quote, he being Sharpe, barely practiced at Kentucky, didn't want to play in games, didn't want to play at the combine. Who's advising him? He can't hide forever. Does he want to play in the summer league? It seems like there's a lot of questions about him, and I'm watching like Zapruder film of him in high school and whatnot. So what happened at Kentucky? Like, how worried? Like, it's all about projection in the NBA, but like at some point, like, you kind of want to see the guy, and he's like, he's not doing anything. He's got self-reported measurables, Jim. They're like, he's got a self-reportable bit. I'm like, how can you buy into that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and he's by far the guy I've seen the least of up in this range. I mean, I didn't watch a ton of the G League either, so if we get on Dyson Daniels, I won't have a ton of input there. But I mean, I haven't seen a lot of Shaedon Sharpe because no one's seen a lot of Shaedon Sharpe. He just hasn't played since high school. Like you mentioned, he hasn't practiced much at Kentucky either. There was a whole ordeal down the stretch of the Kentucky season of, are they going to let Sharpe play a little bit? Is he going to step in and give them some games down the stretch, even just like 20 minutes a game or something? And whether it was his advisors or Calipari not wanting him to play, whatever it was, he never took the court. And so that's, you know, it is all projection. The tools are there. Apparently late in his high school career, he really blossomed the final AAU circuit. He was just a complete killer. I know Jeff Goodman said he was like his favorite guy to watch. I believe Goodman also said he'd have a better college season than Zion Williamson, which obviously is insane. Yeah, insane. Had he taken the court, I still think that would have been crazy to even proclaim. But yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate mystery box. And it's like, we haven't seen anything on the court that we could call a bad habit yet. So it's all kind of a lure of the unknown, as I like to call it.
Yeah, it's wild to me. Like, watch it, it's great. He looks great in the highlights and some of the footage that you're seeing. But like, then you watch like some, you know, like 5 foot kid AAU like on the court with him, and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, he's still playing against other high school kids or whatnot. Like, I don't know. It's amazing to me that he would be projected this high, and he is. Like, there's some projections that have him inside of the top six from a mock draft standpoint. Like, I get it. Like, you know, I wrote down in my notes too, like Indiana could desperately use for like explosive athleticism and a really quick like twitch guy. And he seems like he's that. One of the videos I watched was of his vertical. He seems like he could jump through the gym if you really wanted to, but outside of everything else, man, it's going to be crazy. Like, he's like the fly in the ointment. Where he could go would blow up, you know, draft positions, things like that. Like, he could go within this top six. And like you said, Sacramento could take a risk on him, or I could see him dropping to potentially like top 10.
Yeah, he's a guy like, if the GM's very comfortable in his job security, then maybe he'll be more comfortable taking somebody like that. But he's a guy that could bust so badly because we haven't seen him. And then in hindsight, it looks like a terrible choice and he gets you fired kind of thing. So I don't know exactly what the job security is of each GM as you go down the top 10. But if there's somebody that's on pins and needles, I would imagine he's probably afraid to take the swing on somebody like Sharpe.
So we've talked about, you know, a couple of these players, gotten through five of them at this point. I think we obviously know who the top three is. I kind of feel like I want to make an argument that Keegan Murray might be the fourth best player in this draft because and I didn't realize when I was watching some of his game, I didn't realize how versatile he really was. Like, transition, ability to finish. He shot 72% at the rim, according to Hoop Math. I was surprised by that. A much better three-point shooter than last season. I do wonder, I'll ask you, that's where my first question will be. Do you think that's sustainable? Because he only shot 62% at the free throw line. And that's a really big jump to go from 29% his first year to 39.8%, according to KenPom, his second year. I feel like the real him from three-point range is somewhere in the middle. But if he's like a 36% three-point shooter with his tools offensively, he looks like he's going to be a pretty good player.
Yeah, and I trust the stroke. I really like the mechanics of it. Just, you know, I'm not a shot doctor, but watching him shoot, I feel like, okay, yes, it makes sense to me that goes in more often than would be average. The one thing I'll say is there's almost like a Coors Field aspect to playing for Iowa. Their offenses are always good. The ball movement is incredible. Fran McCaffrey's had year after year of they cut well. The like I said, the on-ball and off-ball movement's great. His efficiency, I think, is propped up a little by that. But even if you knock him like 10% efficiency wise, he's ludicrously efficient. Like, he was crazy, like 130 O rating last year. So I've been mega impressed with him. The other thing too is that he's old. He's like going to be 22 before the season starts. He's not the same age as most sophomores, so I think that might impact the ceiling a little bit. But the skill level is ridiculously high.
Yeah, and I think too, like to your point, when you're talking about where he could fit and the offensive system maximizing his ability, really good point guard like Sacramento again. I think he's a really good fit playing next to De'Aaron Fox type, because I don't think he looks like a really great isolation scorer. Like when they gave him the ball and let him create, didn't really go well a ton. But if you're talking about a guy who's going to create some space for you and like a De'Aaron Fox or something like that, I think he'd be a pretty good fit for a team that's looking for something on the wing, and that'd be Sacramento.
Yeah. Sacramento, I think playing with Lillard in Portland might help, yep, or even yep. like the schemes that Popovich runs in San Antonio is less on ball, give it to a guy and clear out type of situation. So I think any of those would work well for him.
All right, let's go to some of these other guys. And like I said, I think Murray too, his draft position is going to be pretty interesting. There's a couple of these guys, whether it's Ivy, whether it's Murray, that their draft positions are essentially just going to be yes, no props on where they're going to go. Right. And I think like Murray could be one of those two, where is he just going to go to Sacramento? Yes or no? Probably in the range of like 5.5. I would think for a Keegan Murray draft position prop. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, I would think so. Maybe you get it stretched to 6.5 because of all the love Sharp is getting as a potential top six guy. But I think right in that range. Yep.
Yeah. Ooh, 6.5. That might be tempting to play that under. I think Indiana would look at him too. They need some help along the wing, but oh man, we'll see. Johnny Vello over at DraftKings told me sometime after the combine, these draft position props go up. So we'll see maybe in the next week or so. All right, AJ Griffin. Let's talk about him real quick. Was really impressed. The shooting's fantastic. 44% from deep, 44% on mid-range jumpers. Would probably fit really well. We talk about Indiana next to like a Tyrese Halliburton type. Defense, though, is another question. There's a lot of footage of him watching the ball, getting beat on back cuts, not really paying attention too well. But what do you make of Griffin? Because he seems like he's going to be a lethal three-point shooter, but everything else, it does lack.
Yeah, he had like an all-time great freshman shooting season, like off the bounce, off the catch, off screens, like every stats through the roof. His synergy splits are incredible. But there's not a ton of burst on the ball, and he's coming off a bunch of serious knee injuries. Like, I don't think he played as a junior or senior in high school because of injuries. So people are worried that maybe that sapped some of his athleticism. He was like a top three high school prospect before that and fell a little because of the injuries. And then, yeah, defensively, I worry that maybe he's the Parker, like just, I think maybe he tries, but his head gets in the clouds a ton off the ball. That was a big problem with Duke this season, was teams could beat them with back cuts, with running actual off ball action, because they had, you know, Mark Williams, monster defender. We'll talk about him. They had some decent defenders individually, but they still got cooked in a lot of their losses. And Griffin has the tools. He has the size to be a good defender, but he just wasn't this year. So I do worry about that.
Is he, you think he's top 10? Like, I feel like you can find off ball 3-point shooter. Like, he's an effective shooter, but given some of his flaws, like, I am surprised that he is projected like solidly within the top 10.
Yeah. I think medicals will be huge for him because of the injuries, junior and senior. Like, if people are really comfortable that he's going to maintain fully healthy, there's no risk of further injury. And maybe he recovers some of the burst that he showed early in high school, then I could see there being a little more upside than just a wing shooter. Like, he could actually do something on the ball if he gets there.
So one of my favorite guys that I think has some upper mobility here, he's projected to go 10th in actually 11th in Gavoni's latest mock draft in New York. Benedict Mathurin is a guy I like a lot. Like, he is a fantastic shooter. He's got an awesome motion. It's super high up. The release point's really high too. His jump shot, like, it's like he's trying to jump as high as possible. It's crazy how high he gets on some of his jumpers. Looks like a really solid athlete, good in transition, you know, shot creation, maybe not so much, but he can cut really well. Like, I think he could be a really great off ball threat. Could he be a top 10 pick? Cause I look at a guy like him and I see top 10 written all over him. I personally, at least.
Yeah. And he's a like super bouncy, like one of the best dunkers in college basketball when he got his feet under him. And yeah, like the first thing you see is the high release. So I'm glad you hit on that. He elevates. He had some, I would tend to disappear a little bit. Like, you get that with some of these wing guys, where if he's not the primary creator for his team, every once in a while he'd go a game where it'd be like, why'd he only take 6 shots this game? It doesn't make sense. And Arizona was awesome, so they didn't always need him to be the guy. But yeah, that was a little bit concerning, and that makes him more of like a secondary creator guy. I don't think he'll ever be a primary, but the tools are there athletically, the shooting is real. So if you think you can kind of craft that into the ultimate 3-and-D guy, then I kind of buy that. Like, he's not as long as Mikal Bridges. He's not as disruptive, but there's a chance he could be that kind of a 3-and-D impact.
Yeah, and right now, so again, projected to go to about 11th. That's Scavone's latest mock draft. Makes positional sense, I think, for Indiana, who has 6th. Washington at number 10 could work. San Antonio's been pretty intriguing. They got some backcourt talent. DeJounte Murray is point guard. I think he'd work well next to him. And they just unloaded Derek White. So I think they do need a little bit more there. But I think I'd be comfortable in saying he'd be top 10. So I'd be really curious to see what a draft position would be like for him. I put down 12.5 as like a draft position we could see for him. If that's the case, I think I'd play that under. But I might be a little high on that.
Yeah, I think 12.5 is probably good. I mean, he doesn't strike me as, I'm just looking at the 12th pick, Oklahoma City. I don't think he's the kind of gamble that Presti wants, like the swing for the fences kind of guy. But anywhere in that top 11 or from 7 to 11, I think is totally possible for him. Yep.
All right, the other guy that I was really impressed with, Jalen Duren out of Memphis. And I think this seems pretty simple. There's sometimes in drafts, whatever sport, it's just like, you know, square peg, meet peg hole, or whatever you want to call it, meet the square. That would be Jalen Duren in Portland. Like Portland, their center position is a nightmare. Yusuf Nurkic is a free agent this summer, so we'll see what they do with him. I mean, it's Drew Eubanks, Trendon Watford, Reggie Perry, Greg Brown III, Nasir Little. Like that's like their draft. That's their depth chart at power forward and center. Duren just makes all the sense in the world, I think, for Portland, and he seems like he's a pretty good player too.
Yeah, he's a physical monster. Like the size, the athleticism, the physicality he plays with, outstanding. I hope people aren't spooked off of Memphis centers because Wiseman has underwhelmed. Because I think Duren is totally different. He's really young. He's still 18 right now, and I think that is worth considering. He was a reclass up guy and was super productive despite reclassing up. That's pretty rare. I think Marvin Bagley is one of the few that reclassed up and was immediately a stud, and Duren was kind of the same thing. Had some weird backcourt issues with Memphis where maybe he didn't get the ball as much as he should have because of the kind of ball hog guys they had in their backcourt. So I don't hold that against him. I think he will be a force right away as shot blocker, rebounder, and he's got like the mobility and athleticism to be a guy that could switch if you need to on the perimeter.
Yeah. You never want to call anything like a mortal lock, but Portland just seems like a perfect match for him. They desperately need somebody like him.
This is the Hardwood Handicappers Podcast.
Johnny Davis. This is one I'm really excited to get into with you because I watched him play, and it's not that I'm underwhelmed by Johnny Davis. It's just like, so he's a fantastic defender, obviously. And that's going to be, I think, an attractive piece to a lot of people. 6'5", looks like he's about like 200 pounds, showed the ability to defend multiple positions. He can force turnovers too. He's got a nose for the ball. So you really like a lot of that stuff on that end of the floor. And this is where maybe it's just like Big Ten basketball and Wisconsin basketball. Like outside of driving and drawing fouls, what's his game offensively? Because you're underwhelmed by the 3-point shooting, only 30%. He's a good free throw shooter. So again, that should translate to better 3-point shooting. But outside of that and the ability to force fouls, 61% at the rim, 34% on mid-range jumpers, 30%, like I said, on three, it's just a really underwhelming stat line. Is that just because he played in the Big Ten, or is there something there that I'm kind of on?
A little bit to Big Ten. And I think the big kind of split in his season was he did an ankle against Nebraska on January 27th. And I pulled the splits of his shooting before and after then. So before that injury, 16 games, he was a 37% 3-point shooter, 27 to 73. And afterwards, the next, I think 15 games, he went 10 for 48, like 21%. I think there was something there where his lift kind of went away. I think Bart Torvik, a college basketball analytics guy, had done something about it. He had so many dunks in the first 16 games and almost none in the final 15. And some of that's competition. But really, I think there was definitely something there where he had lost some burst, some explosion, some lift on the jumper and his actual jumping ability. So I'm kind of giving him a pass, and maybe, you know, the NBA teams will get a better feel for his medical and how he shoots the ball through workouts and stuff. But I'm pretty high on him. I think halfway through the year, he was probably like a, you know, potential top five pick up in that Keegan Murray range as like, wow, this guy burst onto the scene as a sophomore in the Big Ten. But then he faded because the shooting faded. So you have to kind of assess, do we think that first half splits, those first half splits are real? If they are, then yeah, I mean, he's got even more, you know, juice than you're talking about. And for context, his two-point shooting and free throw shooting didn't really fall off the same way as the three-point shooting. So it makes you kind of think it was the ankle, but we'll see, because yeah, he's awesome defender. He comes from a team that is really disciplined defensively. So I think he's going to know, have a mind for it right away. And the offensive game is the question. So I kind of buy the shooting, but we'll see if he can do it at a high volume in the pros.
Is he a one or a two in your mind?
I think he's going to be a two. I think he should be a two. Maybe he's a hair undersized for that, but he's strong and he's I think he measured pretty well at the combine too. So I think he can play the two.
Yeah, because it's like the projection for him in some of these mock drafts. Washington has landed him a couple of times, that you've seen a running mate next to a Bradley Beal type. That would be an interesting pairing, just because Bradley Beal is pretty ball dominant, but he's actually more of a two. So you wonder how like that backcourt like works together with one another. And what would be interesting there too, talking about the three-point shot, again, just about positional fits, because when you get to this point of the draft, it's about projection and whatnot, but sometimes you get a little bit more positional fit. How he fits for a Washington team that did not shoot the ball very well. Like, hopefully that translates, but they did not shoot very well at all. And I don't know if it would make a lot of sense to draft a guy like that, but if you're saying, like I said, the free throw numbers translate, and if you're talking about the injury kind of holding him back, if he ups that in terms of percentage, he could be a pretty fit there, a pretty good fit there, you know?
Yeah, seems solid. I mean, like I could see New York or Cleveland. Cleveland, he kind of fits the identity with Mobley and Jared Allen, some of the defensive physicality that they've got going. So, you know, he alongside Garland too and Sexton, he's a bigger, bulkier guard. But yeah, I think anywhere in those early teens, again, we without the numbers, without the actual numbers, we're kind of guessing, but I think early teens is where he'll end up.
Yeah, be curious to see what his position prop will be too. But I would assume double digits of some sort, whatever it is, 10 and a half or higher for what he's going to be in terms of draft position props. All right, couple of guys. Now, I haven't had a chance to watch these guys, so I'm going to refer to you, except for one of them. That would be the outstanding player, Ochai Agbaji. But Malachi Branham and Mark Williams. I'll give you the floor for these two, at least in terms of how you project both of them, because as I said, I haven't gotten the chance to watch them as much as some of the other guys you talk about or some of these combine darlings that we're going to bring up. But they have been – this is where you get to the point where, like, the ceiling and the floor for some of these guys are all over the place. You know, Mark Williams seems to be a really good fit for, like, a Charlotte team that needs rim protection and a center who can catch lobs and whatnot. That would make some sense. And then Branham has been projected to land with Cleveland, and kind of like what we're talking about with Davis, they need a secondary guard. Colin Sexton doesn't really look like that's going to work out for them, maybe on the move as well. It would make sense that he lands there. But what do you make of both of those two and the fits potentially for both Charlotte and Cleveland?
Yeah, I love Branham. He was a guy that, you know, was like a top 40-ish recruit, but then suddenly was like the Big Ten freshman of the year. Just a monster score. Like, he can really create for himself. He has a little bit of the high release thing that Mathurin has as well. Big time mid-range shooter, knockdown threes at a really high rate this year. He's not good defensively, though. he was a big part of Ohio State's problems on that end. And they were outside the top 100 in KenPom's defensive efficiency. And that was with EJ Liddell, who's a very good defender. Jamari Wheeler's an awesome point of attack defender. And part of their issues were that Branham just could not keep people in front of him. So that red flag for teams that are really in need of that or prioritizing defensively. But the offensive package is impressive enough to take a chance on him in the lottery, I think. And then Mark Williams, I mean, people went nuts because of the measurements. He basically almost Rudy Gobert sized with his standing reach, 9'9", 4 inches higher than anybody else at the combine. Big time wingspan, great shot blocker. And he like locked down some of the best post scorers in college basketball this year. He gave Drew Timmy nightmares in the game in Las Vegas. So I think he's kind of going to be the guy you can build defense around, but he doesn't have the same offensive upside. So fringe lottery, somebody falls in love with the physical tools, maybe they go for him there. But as far as fit, yeah, I mean, I think he could make sense for Charlotte because of what they need. And they've got some of the perimeter scoring, but it's time to shore up that interior defense.
But and I think defense overall, right, was like, which leads us, because the Hornets do have two first-round picks. They're going to be 13th, and it looks like they're going to be, I believe, 15th. Yeah, because they have that New Orleans selection that translates to them. And what like one of the projections I like for some of these mock drafts is Charlotte going out and getting Mark Williams at 13th and then Ochai Agbaji at 15th. You talk about a team who's been pretty poor defensively. And if you're able to grab those two guys in this draft, you're a young team. And I think those are two really good fits. And Agbaji, I think, is like a dream fit for them. Like, they need a defensive backcourt player. And he's pretty good, I think, in that end of the floor. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but he projects to be, I think, a pretty good 3-and-D prospect. And I think they really need that. A team that shoots a lot of threes and is weak defensively, those two would fit pretty well.
Yep. I love both of those fits as well for them. Agbaji, like, the knock on him, maybe not as great creating, but you're not going to need to if you're playing alongside LaMelo Ball most of the time. So I think he's a terrific fit for somebody that has their creator in place, and you just put him alongside and let him be the knockdown shooter. And yeah, really, really, really solid defensive player as well. So I think Charlotte could do a lot worse than those two guys at 13 and 15.
All right, so that covers pretty much guys who are projected to potentially be lottery selections. So we'll see if, again, when these props come out and we'll have more analysis, we'll be able to get more succinct with it because, of course, we'll know what some of the odds makers are hanging up there. So I wanted to throw three guys at you that keep coming up in reports, good combines, and see where you project them to be. And the reason I want to bring them up, too, is I feel like these are guys that you could potentially get like some like either plus prices or really, really small minus prices on them potentially being first-round selections. It seems like they're maybe heading in that direction. First one that I wanted to throw at you who keeps coming up is Jalen Williams out of Santa Clara. So we were DMing yesterday, and you know, I made the comment, like, I feel like teams are going to look at him and see, what was it, like 7'2" wingspan, 7'1" wingspan, 6'6", the potential ability to shoot, and think, hey, we could get a Mikal Bridges type. But you don't really agree with that assessment.
Yeah, I think he's more of an offensive player than Bridges. Okay. Santa Clara had one of their best season, I think their best season in a decade this year, mostly because of his offense. Like, he was a great shooter. He ran basically their entire pick and roll system. And he was the reason the offense got up to the level that it did. They were still average defensively, despite being huge. Like, they played two bigs most of the time and still really struggled to guard people. He's obviously got crazy length, but he's not disruptive in the same way that Mikal Bridges was. Like, going all the way back to Bridges' freshman year on the 16 title team, he was kind of their lockdown defender. That's not the role Williams has played in college. I'd be hesitant to project him into that in the NBA. But I think he can be a great secondary creator, kind of not the same player, but like the Jordan Poole impact that he's made as a late first round pick, guy that had a lot of untapped offensive upside. I think Williams has that. And with the tools he has to project as a defensive player, then you can kind of talk yourself into him. Full disclosure, I am a Bucks fan. And like a week before the combine, I was telling my buddies after the Bucks season ended, I was like, Jalen Williams is a guy I would love at 24.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's a chance he's gone by then because of the combine he had, both with measurables and with his performance in the scrimmages.
Yeah, I'd be really interested to see what gets hung on him, because I feel like he's not a big enough name where you're going to get like maybe a 30-ish or 29-ish hung on him in terms of a draft position. Maybe, like I said, like a small plus price on him to be a first round pick. But he seems to be one of those guys that is like firmly put his foot in the door of, I'm a first round selection.
Yeah, I think people are going to talk themselves into the upside because of the frame and because of the playmaking instincts he showed. I will almost certainly be betting an under on him.
Yeah. All right. We're in agreement there. So one of the guys that was really impressed going back and watching some of the combine 5-on-5 stuff, Andrew Nembhard looked pretty good. He looked really nice in some of those performances. One of the stat lines, 26 points, 11 assists, some really nice passes in transition, really good reads in terms of running pick and rolls with some of these guys. And I think it's even more impressive because these are guys that he's like, you know, he's getting on the floor with for the first time, essentially, and he's still reading the floor pretty well. Nembhard seems to be a really attractive, and especially in an NBA where, you know, these point guard play is obviously essential. Nembhard seems to be a guy that's going to be a pretty quick riser. I wonder where he would be in terms of a prop, because I know some got him as like a top 35, top 40 prospect. But again, we're talking about flirting with a first round pick. I wonder where he would land in a draft position, because he seems to be one dude that was rising after the combine as well.
Yeah, he's a little older, 4-year college player. So, you know, some of the teams down at the back end that have multiple picks, like, I'd be surprised if he went 30th to Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. where they're maybe looking to gamble a little more. But I think he's super effective. Like, the pick and roll stuff he showed in the scrimmage was fantastic. Like, kind of the snaking the pick and roll, keeping the defender on his hip or on his back, and forcing the defense to play 5-on-4 because he just had his guy in jail. He hit a bunch of pull-up jumpers against drop coverage in those scrimmages. Something he really didn't get a ton of chance to do at Gonzaga. They were playing more through their bigs. He ran a lot of pick and roll, but didn't have the freedom to shoot as frequently and had a lot of weapons with him. So he was passing more, but yeah, I think he's the perfect kind of late first, early second point guard that can be a great backup guard, Monty Morris kind of type, that sort of guy that can score for you a little bit, can really set others up, but it is more just going to be steady, solid, and can knock down shots when he needs to.
Yeah, and that's where the position prop is going to be pretty interesting, because the top end of the second round is where you see some of these older guards go, right? Like Jalen Brunson comes to mind when he came out. It was 3 years at Villanova, right? And then he comes out and he's like, yep, a top end of the second round type of thing.
Malcolm Brogdon was the same way.
Yep. So, and that's where you tend to see these teams take that chance on like the longer in the tooth guards. And like, that'd be a pretty good sweet spot for him. Like if you're talking the range of like 45 and a half or so, if a draft position prop is hung out there on Nembhard, I'd be really curious to see what it is, but he seems to be right in that wheelhouse in terms of being one of those guys worth taking a wager on there if you're a team. All right. Now this is a guy that I had not even heard of until I was reading combine reports. So I'm sure you have watched him before, but all the reviews seem to be glowing. Derquavion Smith out of NC State seems to be really taken off in terms of what he did at the combine. A lot of these scouts seem to really be enthralled with what he brings to the table. So what is he in terms of a player?
He is a big time shooter, both from deep and off the bounce. He basically played in a system where he and another possible draft darling, Darian Sebron, were given just free reign, like kind of you have the ball, we'll run some pick and roll, but it'll be a lot of isolation, not a lot of off ball movement. And so both those guys, it showed off some potential NBA skill sets. And Smith is just a lights out shooter. His free throw percentage doesn't really say it, but he shot almost 40% from deep on a ridiculously high volume. He's just tiny. Like he's short. He's got almost no weight on him at this point. He was a big part of NC State having one of the worst defenses in power conference basketball. So he's more developmental, where you're like, there's shot creation, there's shot making here. We've got to kind of fill in everything around that. But he's really, really young too. So there's a lot of time. He's not quite like Anfernee Simons maybe, but I think that's a decent comparison in terms of shot making and age.
That's funny. That's the comp I was going to ask you, if Anfernee Simons, you know, if that projected out to be, because in the Trailblazers, and it would make sense, right? Because he's developmental. The Blazers get him. His first year doesn't really play that much until like the last game of the season. And by all accounts, you know, you don't really see him, but every single report was Blazers aren't giving up Simons, like Simons. They love him. He's really good. He projects to be something really good. And Smith seems to be potentially one of those similar type of players where you don't know that much, but teams are going to grab him. They're going to be like, no, we're not giving him up. He seems like he's going to project to be pretty good.
Yeah, I think I'm guessing he'll be like late first, where you get the 4-year guaranteed deal rather than the second round. The contracts are a little dicier. You don't know exactly what it's going to be. So I think people will want to lock him into the developmental, like first round contract, have the 4 years, have the restricted free agency at the end of that, where you're kind of in control of a developmental guy, like the same way Simons or Poole or some of those other young guards that go late before the second round, like we mentioned, was where the more veteran guys that are maybe lower ceiling where we see.
I like it. Oh man, I'm excited. It should be a lot of fun in terms of what this draft provides, even though, odds makers don't really buy into the NBA draft as much as they do the NFL draft. So we'll see what offerings are out there. As disappointing.
Odds makers hate those information-based events where it's not, you know, it's not a projection system. It's true information.
Yeah. Well, but Godfrey, I mean, look, out of all these drafts outside of the Major League Baseball draft with like Snore, I'm not going to scout high school pitchers. But out of the two drafts, like the main ones, this one is the most chaotic outside of the top three. I mean, for odds makers, there's a lot of potential to get some money here because yes, there's information, but NBA drafts tend to be pretty chaotic.
Yes, chaotic. There will be trades there, and there's a lot of misinformation too, where reports will be leaked by agents just because they want people to think that their guy's going to go somewhere. So that's, you got to sort through what's real and what's fake in that regard.
Almost like a report that says every NBA team but the Orlando Magic are saying that the Orlando Magic are going to draft Jabari Smith Jr., right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Jim Root, three-man weave, Phil 68. Dude, appreciate it. That was a long one, so thanks for sticking around. Awesome insight. And then once all these props get set up and everything, if you'd be willing, come back on again and we can dissect some of those numbers.
Yeah, willing and able. Hopefully you guys will you'll want me back. That's the key.
Of course, every single time. Jim Root, thanks, man.